The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello and welcome to the fourth reading of All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. I'm Jim Abate. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety and that some of the reading may contain explicit descriptions that some people could find objectionable. In our last reading, when Werner was able to fix a neighbor's wireless, every week another someone stopped by asking for the radio repairman. In November of 1939, rumors of the German invasion ran rampant in Paris. By June, the Germans are bombing Paris, and leaving her book behind because it's too heavy, Marie-Laure and her father leave Paris on foot because the trains are not running. A lance corporal brought Werner to the house of Herr Siedler with his tools. Finding two breaks in one of the resistance wires, Werner is able to fix Herr Siedler's radio. In thanks, Herr Siedler gave Werner cakes of confectioner's sugar and whipped cream, although cream is forbidden, plus 75 Deutschmarks, and will write a letter of recommendation to General Heismeier to get Werner in his technical school. When he returned to the children's home, he smashed his radio with a brick. Marie-Laure and her father are on the way to Évreux to see a man named Monsieur Giannot. Her father carries one of four Sea of Flames. Three are counterfeit and one is real. He does not know which he carries. And now we continue with All the Light We Cannot See. 2. 8 August 1944. St. Malo. Doors soar away from their frames, bricks transmute into power, great distending clouds of chalk and earth and granite spout into the sky. All 12 bombers have already turned and climbed and realigned high above the channel before roof slates blown into the air finish falling into the streets. Flames scamper up walls. Parked automobiles catch fire, as do curtains and lampshades and sofas and mattresses and most of the 20,000 volumes in the public library. The fire pools and struts. They flow up the sides of the ramparts like tides. They splash into alleys, over rooftops, through a car park. Smoke chases dust. Ash chases smoke. A newsstand floats, burning. From the cellars and crypts throughout the city, Malouins send up oaths. Lord God, safeguard this town, its people. Don't overlook us in your name, please. Amen. Old men clutch hurricane lamps. Children shriek, dogs yowl. In an instant, 400-year-old beams and row houses are ablaze. One section of the old city, tucked against the western walls, becomes a firestorm in which the spires of flames at their highest reach 300 feet. The appetite for oxygen is such that objects heavier than house cats are dragged into the flames. Shop signs swing toward the heat from their brackets. A potted hedge comes sliding across the rubble and capsizes. Swifts flushed from chimneys catch fire and swoop like blown sparks out over the ramparts and extinguish themselves in the sea. On the Rue de la Crosse, the Hotel of Bees becomes almost weightless for a moment, lifted in a spiral of flame before it begins to rain in pieces back to the earth. Number 4, Rue Vaubray. Marie-Laure curls into a ball beneath her bed with the stone in her left fist and the little house in her right. Nails in the timbers shriek and sigh. Bits of plaster and brick and glass cascade onto the floor, onto the model city of the table, and onto the mattress above her head. "Papa, papa, papa, papa," Marie-Laure is saying, but her body seems to have detached itself from her voice, and her words make a faraway, desolate cadence. The notion occurs to her that the ground beneath St. Malo has been knitted together all along by the root structure of an immense tree, located at the center of the city in a square no one ever walked her to, and the massive tree has been uprooted by the hand of God, and the granite is coming with it, heaps and clumps and clods of stones pulling away as the trunk comes up, followed by the fat tendrils of roots, the root structure like another tree turned upside down and shoved into the soil. Isn't that how Dr. Giffard might have described it? The ramparts crumbling, streets leaking away, block-long mansions falling like toys. Slowly, gratefully, the world settles. From outside comes a light tinkling, fragments of glass perhaps falling onto the streets. It sounds both beautiful and strange, as though gemstones were raining from the sky. Wherever her granduncle is, could he have survived this? Could anyone? Has she? The house creaks, drips, groans. Then comes a sound like wind in tall grass, only hungrier. It pulls at the curtains, at the delicate parts inside her ears. She smells smoke and knows. Fire. The glass has shattered out of her bedroom window, and what she hears is the sound of something burning beyond the shutters, something huge. The neighborhood, the entire town. The wall, floor, and underside of her bed remain cool. The house is not yet in flames, but for how long? Calm yourself, she thinks. Concentrate on filling your lungs, draining them, filling them again. She stays under her bed. She said, "Ce n'est pas la réalité." Hotel of bees. What does he remember? He saw the engineer Bernd close the cellar door and sit on the stairs. He saw gigantic Frank Volkheimer in the golden armchair pick at something on his trousers. Then the ceiling bulb blinked out, and Volkheimer switched on his field light, and a roar leaped down upon them, a sound so loud it was like a weapon itself, consuming everything, quaking the very crust of the earth. And for an instant, all Werner could see was Volkheimer's light go skittering away like a frightened beetle. They were thrown. For an instant, or an hour, or a day, who could guess how long? Werner was back in Zollverein, standing above a grave a miner had dug for two mules at the edge of a field. And it was winter, and Werner was no older than 5, and the skin of the mules had grown nearly translucent, so that their bones were hazily visible inside, and the little clods of dirt were stuck to their open eyes, and he was hungry enough to wonder if there was anything left on them worth eating. He heard the blade of a shovel strike pebbles. He heard his sister inhale. Then, as though some retaining cord had reached its limit, something yanked him back into the cellar beneath the Hotel of Bees. The floor has stopped shaking, but the sound has not diminished. He clamps his palm to his right ear. The roar remains, the buzzing of 1,000 bees very close. "Is there a noise?" he asks, but cannot hear himself ask it. The left side of his face is wet. The headphones he was wearing are gone. Where is the workbench? Where is the radio? What are these weights on top of him? From his shoulders, chest, and hair, he plucks hot pieces of stone and wood. Find the field of light. Check on the others. Check on the radio. Check on the exit. Figure out what has gone wrong with his hearing. These are the rational steps. He tries to sit up, but the ceiling has become lower, and he strikes his head. Heat, getting hotter. He thinks, we are locked inside a box, and the box has been pitched into the mouth of a volcano. Seconds pass. Maybe they are minutes. Werner stays on his knees. Light. Then the others. Then the exit. Then his hearing. Probably the Luftwaffe men upstairs are already scrabbling through wreckage to help. But he cannot find his field light. He cannot even stand up. In the absolute blackness, his vision is webbed with 1,000 traveling wisps of red and blue. Flames, phantoms, they lick along the floor, then rise to the ceiling, glowing strangely, serenely.
"Are we dead?" he shouts in the dark. "Have we died?"
Down 6 flights. The roar of the bombers has hardly faded when an artillery shell whistles over the house and makes a dull crash as it explodes not far away. Objects patter onto the roof. Shell fragments? Cinders? And Marie-Laure says aloud,
"You are too high in the house,"
and forces herself out from beneath the bed. Already she has lingered too long.
She returns the stone inside the model house and restores the wooden panels that make up its roof and twist the chimney back into place and puts the house into the pocket of her dress. Where are her shoes? She crawls around the floor, but her fingers feel only bits of wood and what might be shards of window glass. She finds her cane and goes in her stocking feet out the door and down the hall. The smell of smoke is stronger out here. The floor still cool, walls still cool. She relieves herself in the sixth-floor toilet and checks her instinct to flush, knowing the toilet will not refill, and double-checks the air to make sure it does not feel warm before continuing. 6 paces to the stairwell. A second shell screeches overhead, and Marie-Laure shrieks, and the chandelier above her head chimes as the shell detonates somewhere deeper in the city. Rain of bricks, rain of pebbles, slower rain of soot. 8 curving stairs to the bottom, the second and fifth steps creak. Pivot around the newel, 8 more stairs, 4th floor, 3rd. Here she checks the tripwire her great-uncle built beneath the telephone table on the landing. The bell is suspended, and the wire remains taut, running vertically through the hole as he has drilled in the wall. No one has ever come or gone. 8 paces down the hall into the 3rd-floor bathroom. The bathtub is full. Things float in it, flakes of ceiling plaster, maybe, and there's grit on the floor beneath her knees. But she puts her lips to its surface and drinks her fill, as much as she can. Back to the stairwell and down to the 2nd floor. Then the 1st. Grapevines carved into the banister. The coat rack has toppled over. Fragments of something sharp are in the hall. Crockery, she decides, from the hutch in the dining room. And she steps as lightly as she can. Down here, some of the windows must have blown out as well. She smells more smoke. Her great-uncle's wool coat hangs from the hook in the foyer. She puts it on. No sign of her shoes here either. What has she done with them? The kitchen is a welter of fallen shelves and pots. A cookbook lies face down in her path like a shotgunned bird. In the cupboard, she finds a half loaf of bread, what's left from the day before. Here, in the center of the floor, the cellar door with its metal ring, she slides aside the small dining table and heaves open the hatch. Home of mice and damp and the stink of stranded shellfish, as if a huge tide swept in decades ago and took its time draining away. Marie-Laure hesitates over the open door, smelling the fires from outside and the clammy, almost opposite smell washing up from the bottom. Smoke. Her great-uncle says it is a suspension of particles, billions of drifting carbon molecules, bits of living rooms, cafes, trees, people. A 3rd artillery shell screams toward the city from the east. Again, Marie-Laure feels for the model house in the pocket of her dress. Then she takes the bread and her cane and starts down the ladder and pulls the trap door shut. Trapped. A light emerges, a light not kindled, Werner prays, by his own imagination. An amber beam wandering the dust. It shuttles across debris, illuminates a fallen hunk of wall, lights up a twisted piece of shelving. It roves over a pair of metal cabinets that have been warped and mauled as if a giant hand has reached down and torn each in half. It shines on spilled toolboxes and broken pegboards and a dozen unbroken jars full of screws and nails. Bolkheimer. He has his field light and is swinging its beam repeatedly over a welter of compacted wreckage in the far corner. Stones and cement and splintered wood. It takes Werner a moment to realize that this is the stairwell. What is left of the stairwell. That whole corner of the cellar is gone. The light hovers there another moment, as if allowing Werner to absorb their situation, then veers to the right and wobbles towards something nearby, and in the reflected light, through skeins of dust, Werner can see the huge silhouette of Bolkheimer ducking and stumbling as he moves between hanging rebar and pipes. Finally, the light settles. with the flashlight in his mouth in those granular, high-slung shadows, Volkheimer lifts pieces of brick and mortar and plaster, chunk after chunk, shredded boards and slabs of stucco. There is something beneath all of this, Werner sees, buried under these heavy things, a form coming into shape. The engineer, Bernd. Bernd's face is white with dust, but his eyes are two voids, and his mouth is a maroon hole. Though Bernd is screaming through the serrated roar lodged in his ears, Werner cannot hear him. Volkheimer lifts the engineer, the older man like a child in the staff sergeant's arms, the field light gripped in Volkheimer's teeth, and crosses the ruined space with him, ducking again to avoid the hanging ceiling, and sets him in the golden armchair still upright in the corner, now powdered white. Volkheimer puts his big hand on Bernd's jaw and gently closes the man's mouth. Werner, only a few feet away, hears no change in the air. The structure around them gives off another tremor, and hot dust cascades everywhere. Soon, Volkheimer's light is making a circuit of what is left of the roof. The three huge wooden beams have cracked, but none has given way entirely. Beneath them, the stucco is spider-webbed, and pipes poke through in two places. The light veers behind him and illuminates the capsized workbench, the crushed case of their radio. Finally, it finds Werner. He raises a palm to block it. Volkheimer approaches. His big, solicitous face presses close. Broad, familiar, deep-sunk eyes beneath the helmet. High cheekbones and long nose flared at the tip like the knobs at the bottom of a femur. Chin like a continent. With slow care, Volkheimer touches Werner's cheek. His fingertip comes away red. Werner says, "We have to get out. We have to find another way out." "Out?" say Volkheimer's lip. He shakes his head. "There is no other way out." 3. June 1940. Chateau. 2 days after fleeing Paris, Marie-Laure and her father enter the town of Evreux. Restaurants are either boarded up or thronged. Two women in evening gowns hunch hip to hip on the cathedral steps. A man lies face down between market stalls, unconscious or worse. No mail service. Telegraph lines down. The most recent newspaper is 36 hours old. At the prefecture, a queue for gasoline coupons snakes out the door and around the block. The first two hotels are full. The third will not unlock the door. Every so often, the locksmith catches himself glancing over his shoulder. "Papa," Marie-Laure is mumbling, bewildered. "My feet." He lights a cigarette. 3 left. "Not much further now, Marie." On the western edge of Evreux, the road empties and the countryside levels out. He checks and rechecks the address the director has given him. "Monsieur François Ginot, 9 Rue Saint-Nicolas." But Monsieur Ginot's house, when they reach it, is on fire. In the windless dusk, sullen heaps of smoke pump upward through the trees. A car has crashed into a corner of the gatehouse and torn the gate off its hinges. The house, or what remains of it, is grand. 20 French windows in the facade, big freshly painted shutters, manicured hedges out front. Un chateau.
"I smell smoke, Papa."
He leads Marie-Laure up the gravel. His rucksack, or perhaps it is the stone deep inside, seems to grow heavier with each step. No puddles gleam in the gravel, no fire brigade swarms out front. Twin urns are toppled on the front steps. A burst chandelier sprawls across the entry stairs.
"What is burning, Papa?"
A boy comes toward them out of the smoky twilight, no older than Marie-Laure, streaked with ash, pushing a wheeled dining cart through the gravel. Silver tongs and spoons hanging from the cart chime and clank, and the wheels clatter and wallow. A little polished cherub grins at each corner. The locksmith says,
"Is this the house of François Ginot?"
The boy acknowledges neither question nor questioner as he passes.
"Do you know what happened to..."
The clanging of the cart recedes. Marie-Laure yanks the hem of his coat.
Papa, please.
In her coat against the black trees, her face looks paler and more frightened than he has ever seen it. Has he ever asked so much of her?
A house has burned, Marie. People are stealing things.
What house?
The house we have come so far to reach.
Over her head, he can see the smoldering remains of door frames glow and fade with the passage of the breeze. A hole in the roof frames the darkening sky. Two more boys emerge from the soot, carrying a portrait in a gilded frame, twice as tall as they are, the visage of some long-dead great-grandfather glowering at the night. The locksmith holds up his palms to delay them.
Was it airplanes?
One says,
there's plenty more inside.
The canvas of the painting ripples.
Do you know the whereabouts of Monsieur Ginot?
The other says,
ran off yesterday, with the rest, London.
Don't tell him anything, says the first.
The boys jog down the driveway with their prize and are swallowed by the gloom.
London, whispers Marie-Laure. The friend of the director is in London?
Sheets of blackened paper scuttle past their feet. Shadows whisper in the trees. A ruptured melon lolls in the drive like an amputated head. The locksmith is seeing too much. All day, mile after mile, he let himself imagine they would be greeted with food, little potatoes with hot cores into which he and Marie-Laure would plunge forkfuls of butter, shallots and mushrooms and hard-boiled eggs and bechamel, coffee and cigarettes. He would hand Monsieur Ginot the stone, and Ginot would pull brass lorgnettes out of his breast pocket and fit their lenses over his calm eyes and tell him, real or fake. Then Ginot would bury it in the garden or conceal it behind a hidden panel somewhere in his walls, and that would be that, duty fulfilled.
Je ne me occupe plus.
They would be given a private room, take baths. Maybe someone would wash their clothes. Maybe Monsieur Ginot would tell humorous stories about his friend the director, and in the morning the birds would sing, and a fresh newspaper would announce the end of the invasion, reasonable concessions. He would go back to the keypound, spend his evenings instilling little sash windows in little wooden houses. Bonjour, bonjour, everything as before. But nothing is as before. The trees seethe and the house smolders, and standing in the gravel of the driveway, the daylight nearly finished, the locksmith has an unsettling thought. Someone might be coming for us. Someone might know what I carry. He leads Marie-Laure back to the road at a trot.
Papa, my feet!
He swings the rucksack around to his front and wraps her arms around his neck and carries her on his back. They pass the smashed gatehouse and the crashed car and turn not east toward the center of Ivrogne, but west. Figures bicycle past, pinched faces streaked with suspicion or fear or both. Perhaps it is the locksmith's own eyes that have been streaked.
Not so quickly, begs Marie-Laure.
They rest in weeds 20 paces off the road. There is only plunging night and the owls calling from the trees and bats straining insects above the roadside ditch. A diamond, the locksmith reminded himself, is only a piece of carving compressed in the bowels of the earth for eons and driven to the surface in a volcanic pipe. Someone facets it, someone polishes it. It can harbor a curse no more than a leaf can, or a mirror, or a life. There is only chance in this world, chance and physics. Anyway, what he carries is nothing more than a piece of glass, a diversion. Behind him, over Ivrogne, a wall of clouds ignites once, twice. Lightning? On the road ahead, he can make out several acres of uncut hay and the gentle profiles of unlit farm buildings, a house and a barn. No movement.
Marie, I see a hotel.
You said the hotels were full.
This one looks friendly. Come, it's not far.
Again, he carries his daughter. One more half mile. The windows of the house stay unlit as they approach. Its barn sits 100 yards beyond. He tries to listen above the rush of blood in his ears. No dogs, no torches. Probably the farmers, too, have left. He sets Marie-Laure in front of the barn doors and knocks softly and waits and knocks again. The padlock is a brand-new single-latch Bourgeois. With his tools, he picks it easily. Inside are oats and water buckets and horseflies flying sleepy loops, but no horses. He opens a stall and helps Marie-Laure into the corner and pulls off her shoes.
"Voila," he says. "One of the guests has just brought his horses into the lobby, so it may smell for a moment. But now the porters are hurrying him out. See, there he goes. Goodbye, horse. Go to sleep in the stables, please."
Her expression is far away, lost. A vegetable garden waits behind the house. In the dimness, he can make out roses, leeks, lettuces, strawberries, most still green, tender white carrots with black earth clotted in their fibers. Nothing stirs. No farmer materializes in a window with a rifle. The locksmith brings back a shirtful of vegetables and fills a tin bucket at a spigot and eases shut the barn door and feeds his daughter in the dark. Then he folds his coat, lays her head on it, and wipes her face with his shirt. 2 cigarettes left. Inhale, exhale. Walk the paths of logic. Every outcome has its cause, and every predicament has its solution. Every lock its key. You can go back to Paris, or you can stay here, or you can go on. From outside comes the soft hooting of owls, distant grumbling of thunder or ordnance, or both. He says, "This hotel is very cheap, ma chérie. The innkeeper behind the desk says our room was 40 francs a night, but only 20 francs if we made our own bed." He listens to her breathe. So I said, "Oh, we can make our own bed." And he said, "Right, I'll get you some nails and wood." Marie-Laure still does not smile.
"Now we go to find Uncle Etienne?"
"Yes, Marie."
"Who is 76% crazy?"
"He was with your grandfather, his brother, when he died. In the war, got a bit of gas in the head, is how they used to say it. Afterward, he saw things."
"What kind of things?"
Creaking rumble of thunder closer now. The barn quakes lightly.
"Things that were not there."
Spiders draw their webs between rafters. Moths flap against the windows. It starts to rain. Entrance exam. Entrance exams for the National Political Institutes of Education are held in Essen, 18 miles south of Zollverein. Inside a sweltering dance hall where a trio of truck-sized radiators is plugged in to the back wall, one of the radiators clangs and steams all day despite various attempts to shut it down. War ministry flags as big as tanks hang from the rafters. There are 100 recruits, all boys. A school representative in a black uniform arranges them in ranks 4 deep. Medals chime on his chest as he paces.
"You are," he declares, "attempting to enter the most elite schools in the world. The exams will last 8 days. We will take only the purest, only the strongest."
A second representative distributes white uniforms. White shirts, white shorts, white socks. The boys shuck their clothes where they stand. Werner counts 26 others in his age group. All but 2 are taller than he is. All but 3 are blonde. None of them wear eyeglasses. The boys spend that entire first morning in their new white outfits, filling out questionnaires on clipboards. There is no noise save the scribbling of pencils and the pacing of examiners and the clunking of the huge radiator. "Where was your grandfather born? What color are your father's eyes? Has your mother ever worked in an office?" 110 questions about his lineage. Werner can accurately answer only 16. The rest are guesses. "Where is your mother from?" There are no options for past tense. He writes, "Germany." "Where is your father from?" "Germany." What languages does your mother speak? German. He remembers Frau Elena as she looked early this morning, standing in her nightdress beside the hall lamp, fussing over his bag, all the other children asleep. She seemed lost, dazed, as if she could not absorb how quickly things were changing around her. She said she was proud. She said Werner should do his best. "You're a smart boy," she said. "You'll do well." She kept adjusting and readjusting his collar. When he said, "It's only a week," her eyes filled slowly as if some internal flood were gradually overwhelming her. In the afternoon, the recruits ran. They crawl under obstacles, do push-ups, scale ropes suspended from the ceiling. 100 children, passing sleek and interchangeable in their white uniforms, like livestock before the eyes of the examiners. Werner comes in 9th in the shuttle runs. He comes in 2nd to last on the rope climb. He will never be good enough. In the evening, the boys spill out of the hall, some met by proud-looking parents with automobiles, others vanishing purposefully 2s and 3s into the streets. All seem to know where they're going. Werner makes his way alone to a Spartan hostel 6 blocks away, where he rents a bed for 2 marks a night and lies among muttering itinerants and listens to the pigeons and bells and shuddering traffic of Essen. It is the first night he has spent outside of Zollverein, and he cannot stop thinking of Jutta, who has not spoken to him since discovering he smashed their radio, who stared at him with such accusation in his eyes that he had to look away. Her eyes said, "You are betraying me," but wasn't he protecting her? On the second morning, there are raciological exams. They require little of Werner except to raise his arms or keep from blinking while an inspector shines a penlight into the tunnels of his pupils. He sweats and shifts. His heart pounds unreasonably. An onion breath technician in a lab coat measures the distance between Werner's temples, the circumference of his head, and the thickness and shape of his lips. Calipers are used to evaluate his feet, the length of his fingers, and the distance between his eyes and his navel. They measure his penis. The angle of his nose is quantified with a wooden protractor. A second technician gauges Werner's eye color against a chromatic scale on which 60 or so shades of blue are displayed. Werner's color is Himmelblau, sky blue. To assess his hair color, the man snips a lock of hair from Werner's head and compares it to 30 or so other locks clipped to a board, arranged darkness to lightest. "Schnee," the man mutters and makes a notation. "Snow." Werner's hair is lighter than the lightest color on the board. They test his vision, draw his blood, take his fingerprints. By noon, he wonders if there is anything left for them to measure. Verbal exams come next. How many National Police Ehrenstalten are there? 20. Who are our greatest Olympians? He does not know. What is the birthday of the Führer? April 20. Who is our greatest writer? What is the Treaty of Versailles? Which is the nation's fastest airplane? Day 3 involves more running, more climbing, more jumping. Everything is timed. The technicians, school representatives, and examiners, each wearing uniforms in subtly different shades, scribble on pads of graph paper with a very narrow gauge, and sheet after sheet of this paper gets closed into leather binders with a gold lightning bolt stamped on the front. The recruits speculate in eager whispers.
"I hear the schools have sailboats, falconries, rifle ranges. I hear they will take only 7 from each group. I hear it's only 4.
They speak of the schools with yearning and bravado. They want desperately to be selected. Werner tells himself, "So do I. So do I." And yet at other times, despite his ambitions, he is visited by instants of vertigo. He sees Jutta holding the smashed pieces of their radio and feels uncertainty steal into his gut. The recruits scale walls. They run wind sprints after wind sprints. On the 5th day, 3 quit. On the 6th, 4 more give up. Each hour the dance hall seems to grow progressively warmer, so by the eighth day the air, walls, and floor are saturated with the hot, teeming odor of boys. For their final test, each of the 14-year-olds is forced to climb a ladder haphazardly nailed to a wall. Once at the top, 25 feet above the floor, their heads in the rafters, they are supposed to step onto a tiny platform, close their eyes, and leap off to be caught in a flag held by a dozen other recruits. First to go is a stout farm kid from Herne. He scales the ladder quickly enough, but as soon as he's on the platform high above everyone else, his face goes white. His knees wobble dangerously. Someone mutters, "Pussy." The boy beside Werner whispers, "Afraid of heights?" An examiner watches dispassionately. The boy on the platform peeks over the edge as if into a swirling abyss and shuts his eyes. He sways back and forth. Interminable seconds pass. The examiner peers at his stopwatch. Werner clutches the hem of the flag. Soon most everyone in the dance hall has stopped to watch, even recruits in other age groups. The boy sways twice more till it's clear he's about to faint. Even then, no one moves to help him. When he goes over, he goes sideways. The recruits on the ground manage to swing the flag around in time, but his weight tears the edges out of their hands, and he hits the floor, arms first, with a sound like a bundle of kindling breaking over a knee. The boy sits up. Both of his forearms are bent at nauseating angles. He blinks at them curiously for a moment, as if scanning his memory for a clue that might explain how he got there. Then he starts to scream. Werner looks away. Four boys are ordered to carry the injured one out. One by one, the remaining 14-year-olds climb the ladder and tremble and leap. One sobs the whole way. Another sprains an ankle when he hits. The next waits at least 2 full minutes before jumping. The 15th boy looks out across the dance hall as if staring into a bleak, cold sea, then climbs back down. Werner watches from his place on the flag. When his turn comes, he tells himself he must not waver. On the undersides of his eyelids, he sees the interlaced ironwork of Zollverein, the fire-breathing mills, men teeming out of elevator shafts like ants, the mouth of Pit 9, where his father was lost, Jutta in the parlor window, sealed behind the rain, watching him follow the corporal to Herr Siedler's house, the taste of whipped cream and powdered sugar and the smooth calves of Herr Siedler's wife. Exceptional. Unexpected. We will take only the purest, only the strongest. The only place your brother is going, little girl, is into the mines. Werner scampers up the ladder. The rungs have been roughly sawed, and his palms take splinters the whole way. From the top, the crimson flag with its white circle and black cross looks unexpectedly small. A pale ring of faces stares up. It's even hotter up here, torrid, and the smell of perspiration makes him lightheaded. Without hesitating, Werner steps to the edge of the platform and shuts his eyes and jumps. He hits the flag in its exact center, and the boys holding its edges give a collective groan. He rolls to his feet, uninjured. The examiner clicks his stopwatch, scribbles on his clipboard, looks up. Their eyes meet for half a second, maybe less. Then the man goes back to his notations. "Heil Hitler!" yells Werner. The next boy starts up the ladder. Brittany. In the morning, an ancient furniture lorry stops for them. Her father lifts her onto its bed where a dozen people nestle beneath a waxed canvas tarp. The engine roars and pops. The truck rarely accelerates past walking speed. A woman prays in a Norman accent. Someone shares pâté. Everything smells of rain. No Stukas swoop over them, machine guns blazing. No one in the truck has even seen a German. For half the morning, Marie-Laure tries to convince herself that the previous days have been some elaborate test concocted by her father, that the truck is moving not away from Paris, but toward it, that tonight they'll return home. The model will be on its bench in the corner, and the sugar bowl will be in the center of the kitchen table, its little spoon resting on the rim. Out the open windows, the cheese seller on the Rue des Patriarches will lock his door and shutter up those marvelous smells, as he has done nearly every evening she can remember, and the leaves of the chestnut tree will clatter and murmur, and her father will boil coffee and draw her a hot bath and say, "You did well, Marie-Laure. I'm proud." The truck bounces from highway to country road to dirt lane. Weeds brush its flanks. Well after midnight, west of Cancale, they run out of fuel. "Not much farther," her father whispers. Marie-Laure shuffles along, half asleep. The road seems hardly wider than a path. The air smells like wet grain and hedge trimmings. In the lulls between their footfalls, she can hear a deep, nearly subsonic roar. She tugs her father to a stop.
"Armies?"
"The ocean." She cocks her head.
"It's the ocean, Marie, I promise."
He carries her on his back. Now the barking of gulls, smell of wet stones, of bird shit, of salt, though she never knew salt to have a smell. The sea murmuring in a language that travels through stones, air, and sky. What did Captain Nemo say? The sea does not belong to tyrants.
"We're crossing into Saint Malo now," says her father. "The part they call the city within the walls."
He narrates what he sees. A portcullis. Defensive walls called ramparts. Granite mansions. A steeple above rooftops. The echoes of his footfalls ricochet off tall houses and rain back onto them. And he labors beneath her weight. And she is old enough to suspect that what he presents as quaint and welcoming might in truth be harrowing and strange. Birds make strangled cries overhead. Her father turns left, right. It feels to Marie-Laure as if they have wound these past 4 days toward the center of a bewildering maze, and now they are tiptoeing past the pickets of some final interior cell, inside which a terrible beast might slumber.
"Rue Vaubrel," her father says between pants. "Here it must be. Ah, here,"
he pivots, retraces their steps, climbs an alley, then turns around.
"Is there no one to ask?" "There is not a single light, Marie. Everyone is asleep or pretending to be."
Finally, they reach a gate, and he sets her down on a curbstone and pushes an electric buzzer, and she can hear it ring deep within the house. Nothing. He presses again. Again nothing. He presses a third time.
"Is this the house of your uncle?"
"It is."
"He doesn't know us," she says. "He's sleeping as we should be."
They sit with their backs to the gate, wrought iron and cool, a heavy wooden door just behind it. She leans her head on his shoulder. He pulls off her shoes. The world seems to sway gently back and forth, as though the town is drifting lightly away, as though back on shore all of France is left to bite its fingernails and flee and stumble and weep and wake to a numb gray dawn, unable to believe what is happening. Who do the roads belong to now, and the fields, the trees? Her father takes his final cigarette from his shirt pocket and lights it. From deep inside the house behind them come footfalls. Madame Manette. As soon as her father says his name, the breathing on the other side of the door becomes a gasp, a held breath. The gate screeches. A door behind it gives way.
"Jesus' mother!" a woman's voice. "You were so small!" "My daughter, madame, Marie-Laure, this is Madame Manette."
Marie-Laure attempts a curtsy. The hand that cups her cheek is strong, the hand of a geologist or a gardener.
"Mon Dieu, there are none so distant that fate cannot bring them together. But, dear child, your stockings and your heels, you must be famished."
They step into a narrow entry. Marie-Laure hears the gate clang shut, then the woman's latching the door behind them. Two deadbolts, one chain. They are led into a room that smells of herbs and rising dough, a kitchen. Her father unbuttons her coat, helps her sit.
We are very grateful. I understand how late it is, he is saying, and the old woman, Madame Manek, is brisk, efficient, evidently overcoming her initial amazement. She brushes off their thank yous. She scoots Marie-Laure's chair toward a tabletop. A match is struck. Water fills a pot. An icebox clicks open and shut. There's the hum of gas and the tick-tick of heating metal. In another moment, a warm towel is on Marie-Laure's face, a jar of cool, sweet water in front of her, each sip a blessing.
Oh, the town is absolutely stuffed, Madame Manek is saying in her fairy tale drawl as she moves about.
She seems short. She wears blocky, heavy shoes. Hers is a low voice, full of pebbles, a sailor's voice or a smoker's.
Some can afford hotels or rentals, but many are in the warehouses, on straw, not enough to eat. I'd take them in, but your uncle, you know, it might upset him. There's no diesel, no kerosene, British ships long gone. They burned everything they left behind. At first I couldn't believe any of it, but Etienne, he has the wireless going non-stop.
Eggs crack, butter pops in a hot pan. Her father is telling an abridged story of their flight, train stations, fearful crowds, omitting the stop in Ivrot. But soon all of Marie-Laure's attention is absorbed by the smells blooming around her. Egg, spinach, melting cheese. An omelet arrives. She positions her face over its steam.
May I please have a fork?
The old woman laughs, a laugh Marie-Laure warms to immediately. In an instant, a fork is fitted into her hand. The eggs taste like clouds, like spun gold. Madame Manek says,
I think she likes it, and laughs again.
A second omelet soon appears. Now it is her father who eats quickly.
How about peaches, dear?
Murmurs Madame Manek, and Marie-Laure can hear a can opening, juice slopping into a bowl. Seconds later, she is eating wedges of wet sunlight.
Marie, murmurs her father, your manners. But we have plenty. You go ahead, child. I make them every year.
When Marie-Laure has eaten two full cans of peaches, Madame Manek cleans Marie-Laure's feet with a rag and shakes out her coat and clanks dishes into a sink and says,
cigarette?
And her father groans with gratitude, and a match flares in the grown-up smoke. A door opens, or a window, and Marie-Laure can hear the hypnotic voice of the sea.
And Etienne, says her father.
Madame says,
shuts himself up like a corpse one day, eats like an albatross the next. He still does not. Not for 20 years.
Probably the grown-ups are mouthing more to each other. Probably Marie-Laure should be more curious about her great-uncle, who sees things that are not there, about the fate of everyone and everything she has ever known. But her stomach is full. Her blood has become a warm golden flow through her arteries and out the open window beyond the walls. The ocean crashes, only a bit of stacked stone left between her and it. The rim of Brittany, the farthest windowsill of France, and maybe the Germans are advancing as inexorably as lava, but Marie-Laure is slipping into something like a dream, or perhaps it's the memory of one. She's 6 or 7 years old, newly blind, and her father is sitting in the chair beside her bed, whittling away at some tiny piece of wood, smoking a cigarette. An evening is settling over the 100,000 rooftops and chimneys of Paris, and all the walls around her are dissolving, the ceilings too. The whole city is disintegrating into smoke, and at last sleep falls over her like a shadow. You have been called. Everyone wants to hear Werner's stories. What were the exams like? What did they make you do? Tell us everything. The youngest children tug his sleeves. The older ones are deferential. This snowy-haired dreamer plucked out of the soot.
They said they accept only 2 from my age group. Maybe 3.
From the far end of the table, he can feel the heat of Jutta's attention.
With the rest of the money from Herr Seidler, he purchased a People's Receiver for 34 marks 80, a two-valve, low-powered radio even cheaper than the state-sponsored Volksens Flangas he has repaired in the houses of neighbors. Unmodified, its receiver can haul in only the big long-wave nationwide programs from Deutschlandsender. Nothing else, nothing foreign. The children shout delighted as he presents it. Jutta shows no interest. Martin Socks says, "Was there lots of moth? Was there cheeses? Was there cakes? Did they let you shoot rifles? Did you ride in tanks? I bet you rode in tanks." Werner says, "I didn't know the answers to half their questions. I'll never get in." But he does. 5 days after he returns from Essen, the letter is hand-delivered to Children's House. An eagle and cross on a crisp envelope, no stamp, like a dispatch from God. Frau Elena is doing laundry. The little boys are clustered around the new radio, a half-hour program called Kids Club. Jutta and Claudia Foster have taken three of the younger girls to a puppet show in the market. Jutta has spoken no more than 6 words to Werner since his return. "You have been called," says the letter. Werner is to report to the National Political Institute of Education, number 6, at Schulpforta. He stands in the parlor of Children's House trying to absorb it. Cracked walls, sagging ceiling, twin benches that have borne child after child after child for as long as the mine has made orphans. He has found a way out. Schulpforta, tiny dot on the map near Naumburg in Saxony, 200 miles east. Only in his most intrepid dreams did he allow himself to hope that he might travel so far. He carries the sheet of paper in a daze to the alley where Frau Elena boils sheets amid billows of steam. She rereads it several times. "We can't pay." "We don't need to." "How far?" 5 hours by train. They've already paid the fare." "When?" 2 weeks. Frau Elena, strands of hair stuck to her cheeks, maroon aprons under her eyes, pink rims around her nostrils, thin crucifix against her damp throat. Is she proud? She rubs her eyes and nods absently. "They'll celebrate this." She hands the letter back and stares down the alley at the dense ranks of clotheslines and coal bins. "Who, Frau?" "Everyone, the neighbors." She laughs a sudden and startling laugh. "People like that Weissminster, the man who took your book." "Not Jutta." "No, not Jutta." He rehearses in his head the argument he will present to his sister. Pflicht, it means dirty, obligation, every German fulfilling his function. Put on your boots and go to work. Ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer. We all have parts to play, little sister. But before the girls arrive, news of his acceptance has reverberated through the block. Neighbors come over one after another and exclaim and wag their chins. Coal wives bring pig knuckles and cheese. They pass around Werner's acceptance letter. The ones who can read, read it aloud to the ones who cannot. And Jutta comes home to a crowded, exhilarated room. The twins, Hanna and Suzanne Gerlitz, sprint laps around the sofa, looped up in the excitement. And 6-year-old Rolf Hupfauer sings, "Rise, rise, all glory to the fatherland." And several of the other children join in. And Werner doesn't see Frau Elena speak to Jutta in the corner of the parlor, doesn't see Jutta run upstairs. At the dinner bell, she does not come down. Frau Elena asks Hanna Gerlitz to lead the prayer and tells Werner she'll talk to Jutta, that he ought to stay downstairs. All these people are here for him. Every few breaths, the words flare in his mind like sparks. You have been called. Each minute that passes is one fewer in this house, in this life. After the meal, little Siegfried Fischer, no older than 5, walks around the table and tugs Werner's sleeve and hands him a photograph he has torn from a newspaper. In the picture, 6 fighter bombers float above a mountain range of clouds. Spangles of sun are frozen mid-glide across the airplane's fuselages. The scarves of the pilots stretch backward. Siegfried Fischer says, "You show them, won't you?" His face is fierce with belief. It seems to draw a circle around all the hours Werner has spent at Children's House, hoping for something more. "I will," Werner says. The eyes of all the children are on him. "Absolutely, I will." Occuper. Marie-Laure wakes to church bells. 2, 3, 4, 5. Faint smells of mildew. Ancient down pillows with all the loft worn out. Silk wallpaper behind the lumpy bed where she sits. When she stretches out both arms, she can almost touch walls on either side. The reverberations of the bells cease. She has slept most of the day. What is the muffled roar she hears? Crowds, or is it still the sea? She sets her feet on the floor. The wounds on the backs of her heels pulse. Where is her cane? She shuffles so she does not bash her shins on something. Behind curtains, a window rises out of her reach. Opposite the window, she finds a dresser whose drawers open only part way before striking the bed. The weather in this place, you can feel it between your fingers. She gropes through a doorway into what? A hall? Out here, the roar is fainter, barely a murmur.
Hello?
Quiet. Then a bustling far below, the heavy shoes of Madame Manette climbing flights of narrow, curving steps. Her smoker's lungs coming closer, third floor, fourth. How tall is this house? Now Madame's word is calling.
Mademoiselle!
And she is taken by the hand, led back into the room in which she woke, and seated on the edge of the bed.
Do you need to use the toilet? You must. Then the bath. You had an excellent sleep. Your father is in town trying the telegraph office, though I assured him that'll be about as profitable as trying to pick feathers out of molasses. Are you hungry?
Madame Manette plumps pillows, flaps the quilt. Marie-Laure tries to concentrate on something small, something concrete. The model back in Paris, a single seashell in Dr. Giffard's laboratory.
Does this whole house belong to my great-uncle Etienne? Every room. How does he pay for it?
Madame Manette laughs.
You get right to it, don't you? Your great-uncle inherited the house from his father, who was your great-grandfather. He was a very successful man with plenty of money. You knew him. I have worked here since Master Etienne was a little boy. My grandfather, too, you knew him? I did. Will I meet Uncle Etienne now?
Madame Manette hesitates.
Probably not. But is he here? Yes, child, he's always here.
Always? Madame Manette's big, thick hands enfold her.
Let's see about the bath. Your father will explain when he returns.
Well, that's all the time we have as we've come to the end of the book hour. And today's reading of All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Dewar. Preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.